This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Exciting comic strip adventures are now appearing every day, including Sunday, in the Chicago Herald American. And tell all your friends about us, too. Remember the paper, the Chicago Herald American.
Destination, freedom. Listen.
Freedom Bell, my friends. And this is Paul Revere, called back from the shadows by the sound of the Freedom Bell, to cry again a warning that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
Destination Freedom is presented by Station WMAQ in the interest of human freedom the world over. Paul Revere is the symbol of warning, ready to ride down the skies to shout his alarm. His destination, now and forever, freedom.
The task that confronts freedom-loving people all over the world in 1951 is staggering and awful in the implications of what may happen if we lack courage and vision and if we do not fully accept the challenge of the future. Our destiny at the moment may lie largely in the hands of one man, a man who has been chosen by fate to create a bulwark of defense against the ever-increasing hordes of communism. That man is Dwight David Eisenhower, whose destination in 1951 is undeniably the preservation of freedom for all the democratic peoples of the world. You know, somebody once said that every man is really three personalities: the man he thinks he is, the man other people think he is, and the man he really is. Well, let's ask a neighbor of Eisenhower's, editor Charles Harger, who's been called the William Allen White of Abilene, Kansas, what he thinks of the general.
Ike Eisenhower? Sure, we know him well around Abilene. We Kansans like to claim him as a native son, but I guess he really belongs to the Lone Star State, too, since he was born in Denison, Texas. But we feel he's our boy. And he feels about our way of life the way Kansans do, the way Americans do.
Democracy? Look what it's done for me. Took me off a Kansas farm, gave me the best education in the world, gave me a chance to make a career for myself.
That's an endorsement, all right, isn't it, of what he stands for? Yes, sir, Ike's a real American. Well, his forefathers came to the New World over 200 years ago to escape wars and religious persecution. And the general returned to Europe in the 1940s to lead a great crusade to free the old world from the tyrannies of our generation. And now he's got the job to do again. We're betting out here in Abilene that he's the man for the job. One day around the start of World War II, when he wasn't so prominent, I remember Eisenhower came back to Abilene for a short visit, and we met him at the station. Well, welcome back, Ike. Hi, you look burned up over something.
Charlie, it's good to see you. Burned up? I am. I've just been talking to the worst bunch of isolationists you've ever seen. You're an editor, Charlie. Is that the way people feel?
Abilene studies her history books, Ike, remember? But I'll admit we're pretty apathetic as a nation. A lot of folks still don't think we're going in.
Not in? Why, we've been in for months. What about lend-lease? Don't they know what that means? We're providing the oil for the wick of freedom, Charlie.
Yes, Ike. And we'll be afire ourselves before long, I'm afraid.
People ought to know what's going on. Japan's been preparing for war for 10 years, and they're going to jump us one of these days, and we'll have nothing to fight them with.
You don't sound much like a man getting ready to retire, Ike. You change your mind?
Guess so. Thought this time I'd be moving back to Abilene for that little white house and garden and peace, but not right now. This country's going to need every soldier she can scrape up, so... But now that I've got that off my chest, let's hunt up some chow.
Ike Eisenhower never was one to go spoiling for a fight. His method is to scotch it before it starts. And if you can't head it off, prepare for it and fight it out as well as you can. Take, for instance, when he was a lad home from West Point for one of his rare leaves. Orrin Snyder tells his son Ike. Orrin's a farmer now, but he was once a football coach who helped teach the general good sportsmanship. Something that came natural to Eisenhower.
Well, Orrin, hometown looks mighty good after all those gigs and restrictions at the point.
We've been having a few restrictions ourselves around Abilene, Ike.
Oh? What do you mean?
It seems that town's developed a local bully while you've been away. A fellow named Dirk Taylor. A heavyweight.
Dirk? Mm-hmm. Oh, I know him. He was just a handyman, mowing lawns, doing odd jobs. What's got into him?
He's a good fighter and he knows it. Pretty cocky. He goes around making trouble. Says he can lick any man in Kansas. Now, the fact is, Ike, we've been badgered by this champion a little too long. He thinks no one in this part of the country can stand up against him for one round. Now, you've been getting quite a reputation at the point as a boxer. Why don't you take him on? Well, Ike decided to do just that. He changed clothes and went over to the barbershop where Dirk hung out and seated himself in the chair for a shave. Dirk, seated in a corner, watched Ike closely and mumbled,
"I could knock out any man in Kansas."
"Dirk, I know you're good. So how'd you like to go across the street to the basement of Sterl's clothing store and we'll see just how good you are?"
"Sure. There ain't nothing better I'd like to do."
The word spread and all the neighborhood followed Ike and Dirk to the appointed place. Well, the fight started. It was even in the first round, and then in the middle of the second round, Ike landed an uppercut that knocked Dirk out. The invincible heavyweight came out of the scrap sadder but wiser. And they became good friends. Ike's got another bully that he's going up against now. And we can be dead sure when he's trained enough, he'll be trying another uppercut. He hates bullies. We all do, and he believes every decent person's got a right to be unmolested. So we'll be watching him in Europe. And we'll be behind him, as we were in those days. Another thing about Ike Eisenhower, he likes to deal squarely with facts and problems. We need that kind of man today. And Miss Annie Hopkins of Abilene remembers another visit of Ike's when he had graduated from the point.
"Second Lieutenant Eisenhower. Well, you make a fine-looking officer, Dwight."
"Thank you, Miss Annie."
"And where are you off to now?"
"Fort Sam Houston, San Antonio, for my first regular Army duty."
"We're all so proud of you, Dwight."
"There were times, Miss Annie, when I didn't know if I'd make it."
"We never doubted. Especially those of us who had you in school."
"One of the reasons I came back was to thank you. I appreciate especially all those times I was dressed down for mistakes I made. You didn't handle me with gloves on, and I'm grateful. Sometimes we wear gloves in our relationships with people when it calls for bare hands."
"Dwight was a good student, but not a scholar. He was fun-loving, good-natured, popular. He was excellent in history and mathematics. Good things to know in 1951. And two other qualities he developed early. Strength and spirit. He became strong as an ox and the scrappiest kid in school. He never dodged a necessary fight for what he thought was right. And he trained himself to win. On September 8, 1943, the day before the landings in Salerno, Dwight wrote a letter to his son, Johnny.
By the time you get this letter, Johnny, you know that today was a very full one for me. One crowded with anxiety. However, being made as I am, it is also crowded with hopefulness. I'm probably the most optimistic person in the whole world. Everybody else sees all the risks and dangers, and I guess I'm just a wishful thinker because I just shut my eyes and say, we'll go ahead and try to win. One of these days, I'll probably get a very bloody nose, but I hope it isn't this time.
This letter was written from Allied Force Headquarters, where Eisenhower was trying to solve the early problems of World War II. His son Johnny was training for the infantry, and the general still found time to write him words of advice and affection. Eisenhower's always been close to his family. His wife, Marie Geneva Dowd, known as Mamie, has been described aptly as the true symbol of an American wife and mother. She regrets, as many another soldier's wife, the military order which forbids wives to accompany their husbands when they go off to war.
I would like to be with him, of course. But I'm no different from any other woman whose husband goes off to war. War is bigger than I or any other person.
When the general's away, Mamie writes him copious letters.
Men like quantity, not quality, in letters.
And she does not complain when short notes of 5 or 6 lines come back in answer. One of Mrs. Eisenhower's favorite stories comes from the last war. She was calling her grocer about an undelivered order.
Hello? Yeah?
This is Mrs. Eisenhower. I wonder if my order is ready. I called early this morning and I've got to keep an appointment in a hurry. Could you rush my order over to me, please?
Listen, lady, don't you know there's a war on?
Mister, you're telling me.
Moving from post to post, like other soldiers' wives, Mimi Eisenhower has somehow always managed to create a home. But, of course, she misses him.
Nobody knows how I miss him. I miss hearing him talk. He's informed on almost everything. He's a brilliant conversationalist. I've lived with him and listened to him for 34 years, and he still fascinates me. But
we interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Every other woman misses her husband. And every mother misses her son just as much. In this, we have everything in common.
It takes a lot of doing to make a man a great military leader. Doing that involves experience in the field and training at the Command and General Staff School, the Army War College, and the Army Industrial College. Well, Ike made the grade in all these advanced schools, and he made the grade in the field, too. His first command won him the Distinguished Service Medal for being a first-rate organizer. He served 3 years in the office of the Assistant Secretary of War, and from 1933 to 1935, he served under General Douglas MacArthur in the office of Chief of Staff. 20 years of preparation were behind Ike, and he was ready and waiting for the toughest assignment the Army could find.
Mamie, where are you? You home?
Ike, what on earth happened?
Mamie, my orders have come.
Ike, put me down. What are you raving about?
We're going to the Philippines.
Really? When? Oh, you're joking. We'll never get out of Washington.
That's what I thought. But we're going to the Philippines to set up a system of flying fields. Pack your bags. We're leaving almost yesterday.
Hey, and that was a job well done. Ike returned to the States in February 1940 to command the 15th Infantry at Port Louis, Washington, for a few months before becoming Chief of Staff to the 3rd Division. From February to June 1941, he was Chief of Staff to the 9th Corps with temporary rank of Colonel, and on June 24th, he became Chief of Staff to the 3rd Army. It was in the autumn maneuvers of 1941 in Louisiana that Eisenhower began his spectacular rise. As Chief of Staff to General Walter Kruger, he directed the operations of 200,000 men in the 3rd Army with such skill, intelligence, and good humor that he won the admiration of all observers.
And that, gentlemen, is the last of the maneuvers. Ike, come into my tent a moment. I have good news for you. Here's a piece of paper. I think it'll be of interest to you. Come on, open it.
General Kruger?
Yes, General Eisenhower. How does it feel to be a brigadier?
Later, on December 7th, the Japs made the sneak attack, which Eisenhower had prophesied years before. Shortly after the outbreak of war, he was made head of the War Plans Division. Few Americans realize what a tremendous revolution in outlook and planning preceded and accompanied the entrance of our army into World War II. Within less than 2 years, the army was forced to abandon its traditional role as a small defense force and was transformed into an organization capable of conducting operations in a global war. For 6 months after his appointment to the War Plans Division, Eisenhower worked night and day on plans for utilization of our expanding army to its best advantage.
That you, Ike?
Amy, you shouldn't be up. 3 o'clock.
Oh, I'm going to get you some milk and sandwich or something.
Oh, no, thank you. Just feels good to sit down here with you.
Don't be discouraged, Ike. I know how you must feel with all the bad news in the newspapers, but...
The Axis seems too strong, Mimi. The problem is we can't make our power felt until we check the offensive action of Germany and Japan. And we've got to hold some bases at all costs. I'm sure the average citizen watching what we're trying to do must be very confused. For instance, this column in tomorrow morning's paper. Read it.
How can we expect to counter enemy concentration of strength by our amateur leadership, which suffers badly compared to the professional skill of the enemy? Why don't they have faith?
Maybe it's an advantage sometimes, Mamie, to be underestimated.
Discover the life-changing benefits of Meow Greens for your cat. Ever see your cat slowing down or having health issues and wonder, what can I do to make them better? Well, my friend, add Meow Greens to your cat's food for 90 days, and I guarantee you'll see changes that will amaze you. Greetings, I'm naturopathic Dr. Dennis Black, inventor of Meow Greens, and I invite you to take the Meow Greens 90-Day Challenge. In the first 30 days, you'll see shinier coats and increased energy. By day 60, your cat will have a stronger immune system, less shedding, improved joint function, all due to the live nutrients that you've added to their diet. And at 90 days, they're going to have better digestion, reduced inflammation, improved heart health, and you may even have reduced their cancer risk. Fetch a free Jumpstart trial bag for your cat today. Go to trymeowgreens.com. Use promo code TRYMEOW. That's try, M-E-O-W. You discover the shipping. You don't have to change your cat's food to improve your cat's health. Just add a packet of Meow Greens.
underrated American and British military leadership went on to bring about the great strategic surprise of November 8, 1942. That, combined with the El Alamein operation, caught the Axis off guard in North Africa. Then came the German disaster at Stalingrad, and the forces of freedom wrested the initiative from the Axis. England was the main outpost of freedom in Western Europe, and our plans for operation against Germany began there. After a chain of defensive outposts had been secured in the Atlantic, a headquarters for the European Theater of Operations was set up in London. To head this command, General Marshall chose Eisenhower. He arrived in London on June 4th, 1942.
Tobruk has just fallen with a loss of 30,000 British troops. Rommel is advancing in Egypt, and before his momentum can be checked, further grievous losses in men and equipment will have to be suffered. I realize that defeatist sentiments are widespread. Therefore, I should like to create an atmosphere at this time for our European theater of operations. Defeatism and pessimism will not be tolerated at this headquarters. Any soldier or officer who cannot rise above the recognized obstacles and bitter prospects that lie in store for us has no recourse but to ask for a transfer. Those who don't will go home for reassignment.
Eisenhower had other problems to be solved, however. The thousands of American troops pouring into Great Britain had not only to be trained for combat, but welded to the English soldiers in a fighting partnership, and American GIs were outspoken about the ETO.
Talk about lousy weather. Nothing but rain and fog.
And the food. Don't they like nothing but fish and kidney stew?
Yeah, the women. Boy, what clothes. Sids and Roebuck 1910.
And do you notice nobody ever laughs over here?
We were guests of necessity, but we griped, as is the way of American soldiers with high morale. One of the first plans by General Ike to get the American and Englishman together was to set up for the troops a program of sightseeing visits to bombed areas and historic sites. Army newspapers and recreation officers concentrated on Anglo-American cooperation. And thus the lull before the battle was used to weld British and American forces into a team that had absolute confidence in the other fellow. Part of Eisenhower's success stemmed from this achievement in Britain, and Ike's personality was destined to win him more honors. Churchill, with whom he lunched twice a week, had a talk with him one day.
We're very much impressed, General Eisenhower, with your tech, common sense, vision, and grasp of military realities.
That's very generous, Mr. Churchill.
You'll be interested in attending our conference this afternoon. You can arrange to be present.
Well, thank you, yes.
We've found you to be a great friend of the British, and I think you'll find us to be a great friend of yours. See you at 3.
Since the plans of the Joint Chiefs of Staff call for an invasion of North Africa before Europe, the choice of a theater commander had to be made. The smoothness and precision with which the ETO headquarters worked gave Churchill a measure of Eisenhower's efficiency as an administrator. Thus, he felt justified in entrusting the command of British military and naval forces to a man who had never directed combat operations. As soon as the time for the North African invasion was determined, Eisenhower called British and American officers together in Norfolk House.
Gentlemen, let me say initially that the command arrangements of 1918 are inadequate for projected operations in the Mediterranean theater. Logistics alone require something more. All shipping must be pooled. Common bases must be used. Equipment, information, supplies, even personnel must be combined or used on an interchangeable basis. For land, sea, and air operations of such magnitude, mutual trust and confidence must exist from the bottoms of both armies to the top.
Never before in history have two Allied powers merged their military identities more completely in a single effort. Time and again, Eisenhower nipped disagreements in the bud. by getting both sets of offending officers together in the same room and forcing them to thrash out their differences. Eisenhower's methods were direct. He was accessible to anyone who had business with the commander-in-chief. To nervous juniors tiptoeing around the office...
Look, Lieutenant, you don't have to tiptoe around here. If you have anything to show me, bring it in.
And again, Eisenhower insisted that reports be simple and direct. Ponderous memoranda were thrown back to the officers who wrote them with the remark,
"This is too complicated for a dumb bunny like me. What's it all about?"
The decision to invade French North Africa involved General Eisenhower in the most complicated amphibian operation in military history. But Eisenhower's idea of coordinated arms sliced into Axis power and won the victory in Africa. His crusade in Europe after a victorious invasion has been narrated in several excellent volumes. When victory had come on May 8, 1945, Eisenhower remarked,
"Full victory in Europe has been attained. Working and fighting together in a single and indestructible partnership, you have achieved a perfection in unification of air, ground, and naval power that will stand as a model in our time. As we celebrate victory in Europe, let us remind ourselves that our common problems can best be solved in the same conception of cooperation and devotion to the cause of human freedom as have made this expeditionary force such a mighty engine of righteous destruction."
The question of what Eisenhower would do after the war became a matter of public discussion. He served as chief of staff until 1948, when he was warned that he might be drafted as presidential candidate, to which he replied in typical Eisenhower language,
"I am not available for and could not accept nomination to high political office. My decision to remove myself from the political scene is definite and positive. There is nothing in the international or domestic situation which especially qualifies me for the most important office in the world."
So it was that on June 7, 1948, General Dwight David Eisenhower put aside his uniform and became the 13th president of Columbia University. His innovations at Columbia are well known, such as the forming of citizens' committees to study national and international problems. But perhaps he dreamed too now and then of still going back one day to Abilene, to the little white house and garden and peace.
"But not right now. This country's going to need every soldier she can scrape up."
So in February of 1949, General Ike left the comparatively quiet life at Columbia University and returned to serve his country as presiding officer to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Quibbling was defeating unity in our defense planning. Aye, the old magic was still at work, and it brought success. The smiling directness, the ability to stand up to facts, to call a spade, reminded all Americans that here was a real champion of freedom. A modest, though determined, champion of freedom.
"I'm probably the most optimistic person in the world. Everybody else sees all the risks and dangers, and I guess I'm just a wishful thinker, because when I just shut my eyes and say, we'll go ahead and try."
Modesty is a great virtue. Then came the year of crisis, the year of decision, 1951, bringing with it a great need for calm leadership and sound planning, and the will to unite free nations in a common defense against encroaching barbarism. And again, General Ike said,
"Yes, I'll try."
So General Ike is now occupied with his new job, to create a great unity among the free nations of Europe, to inspire them, to give them the will to face up to a fight if a bully begins aggression. Well, what of the future? What can the free nations say to a bully?
There is power in our union and resourcefulness on sea, land, and air. Aroused and united, there is nothing which the nations of the Atlantic community cannot achieve. Let those who might be tempted to put this power to the test ponder well the lessons of history. The cause of freedom can never be defeated.
Modest man, an optimist, and a military leader of proven merit. General Ike always keeps trying. With hope for the future, America is counting on General Eisenhower. Aye, and the world is counting on him too, with but one desire, to take another step along the road to destination freedom.
Paul Revere, portrayed by Maurice Copeland, will return next Sunday to narrate the next chapter in the story we call Destination Freedom. Presented by station WMAQ in the interest of human freedom the world over. Today's script was written by Bill Hodapp and produced under the direction of John Collin. Jack Lester played General Eisenhower. Other members of the cast were Fern Persons, Alma Plotz, Donald Gallagher, and Arthur Peterson. The special music was composed by Emil Soderstrom and was played by Helen Morton and Jose Bethencourt. Our engineer was George Wilson. Sound effects were created by Cliff Mueller. And now this is Charles Mountain reminding you, the sound of the Freedom Bell is your invitation to follow Paul Revere along the road to destination freedom. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Discover the life-changing benefits of Meow Greens for your cat. Ever see your cat slowing down or having health issues and wonder, what can I do to make them better? Well, my friend, add Meow Greens to your cat's food for 90 days, and I guarantee you'll see changes that will amaze you. Greetings, I'm naturopathic Dr. Dennis Black, inventor of Meow Greens, and I invite you to take the Meow Greens 90-Day Challenge. In the first 30 days, you'll see shinier coats and increased energy. By day 60, your cat will have a stronger immune system, less shedding, improved joint function, all due to the live nutrients that you've added to their diet. And at 90 days, they're going to have better digestion, reduced inflammation, improved heart health, and you may even have reduced their cancer risk. Fetch a free Jumpstart trial bag for your cat today. Go to trymeowgreens.com. Use promo code TRYMEOW. That's try M-E-O-W. You discover the shipping. You don't have to change your cat's food to improve your cat's health. Just add a packet of Meow Greens.